Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingenstein.
Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingenstein with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're happy to have join us Steve Nash. Steve is the founder of Traditional Excellence Human Performance. He's a retired lieutenant colonel. He spent 25 years in the Canadian military, and he has taught and led many teams over his career. And he has some great lessons that he's going to share with us. Looking forward to today's conversation with Steve. Well, I guess for our listeners, could you give a little bit of your story, a little overview of your career?
Sure. I'm lucky right now. I'm an educator by profession and training. I spent 25 years in the Canadian military, was lucky enough to be a combat arms commander. I commanded paratroopers, and I was very lucky to serve in Canadian special operations, including in Canada's two special mission units, one of which I was the acting commanding officer and the second which I was the commanding officer. So if nothing else, I've been very lucky in my life. So I was medically released almost 14 years ago. So going back into the real world, I had to retool myself to better match what people needed and wanted, because my previous experience, all of my adult life when I retired, had been in a military setting. And although there are many things that cross over usefully, some do not cross over. And in certain groups at certain points in time, it's not a neutral to come from a military background. In 2024 in Canada, it's often a big giant negative. So I don't disregard my military service, but I did understand that I needed to retrain and retool myself for other things. So that's kind of where I am now, in a position with my own small company, teaching at colleges and universities, and continuing to engage with groups and individuals who just want to get better at what they want to do.
Yeah. So if you were to go back and talk to that 22-year-old Steve and give him some advice, I guess, first off, do you think he would have listened?
The first piece of advice I'd give was stop looking at me like that and start listening. Because, you know, I wouldn't say that I changed very much, because I'm a believer that for all the hooks and crooks, by all my faults and all the things I got wrong, they all led me to here, including to this discussion. So I'm grateful for all those. And my upbringing, my youth was relatively modest or minus. So I'm very lucky to be here, having done these things. But I guess the thing that I would say most, one, you already mentioned one, you should listen. And two, try to keep everything in balance. Everything balanced. Because I believe now I better understand that there is a too much and there is a not enough of everything. And when you disregard that, there's a price to be paid. It could be paid immediately, but eventually you'll pay that price. Right? So I guess I would tell myself that. Because if I recall anything about myself being a 22-year-old, it was a 22-year-old smarty pants who knew everything and could cut about and do everything I dreamed of. And some of that's quite useful. And some of that is the burden or the problem.
So every leader learns in a crisis situation. Talk about, you know, you've been in, I'm sure, life and death situations in the military. Talk about just some of those lessons that you think are applicable to kind of a first-time leader.
Well, I think it seems to me that you really learn in the crisis. You learn really quickly, especially when things go wrong. And part of my retooling, I'm working through a doctorate of education right now as a pretty slow learner. You know, I'm not that smart and generally lazy. So it's a struggle, but I have to struggle. It's part of that's the way I have to do it. But this idea that we can get everything right and correct and everything's going to work out, I don't think it's not true. It's not true to start with. And it's not that useful for leadership. So I believe that an educational studies and research, neurology shows that we learn when we make mistakes, when we get it wrong, when there's confusion, complexity, errors. And if it's a stinging failure, we will learn instantly. We'll snap our heads and say, I really didn't like that. So the challenge becomes how to survive those terrible things and make it something useful. So for leadership, I used to believe that leaders were only required when things were really bad. Like that's when you really need it. And some of that I still believe, that you really need leadership. You don't need much leadership when things are great, because it's okay. It's when things are bad, things are wrong, things are failing, things are terrible, that you could really use leadership, especially the component of leadership, which is a subjective trust relationship between people. It's very special and very powerful. But I also learned over time, and now I would say, you can create the leadership dynamic and the power of leadership in your team when things are not bad. You can do small things all the time to create that feeling of trust, like you can trust me. So small mistakes. I was talking to some young athletes the other day and trying to say to them, when things go wrong, a leader or someone who wants to be a leader has a real choice to make a difference that someone will never forget. Because if you're playing in a high-end activity in sport or in business and something goes wrong, you know you've done wrong. And high-order athletes already feel bad. They feel terrible. So if you light into them and ride on that failure, they will never forget it. But if you in that moment look at them and say, you know what, you effed up, I got it. Now take a breath in, wipe the tears out of your corny eyes. I need you back in the game. I need you back there because you're our top performer, or you're going to bring something to the team. And they will never forget that either. They will never forget that moment where they know that they made a mistake and you look at them and you know as well, and you say, I got it. That's done. Get your proverbial shirt together, take a breath, and get back out there. Get back in the game. Mm-hmm. And that is, to me, a real sort of turning point in developing that subjective trust relationship that allows leadership to really take care of people in the worst of times, if that makes sense.
So thinking back to that first leadership position, was that in the military that you had your first leadership?
Well, I was, those are my first really serious ones as a young officer in the military. I was lucky that I started martial arts in my teens, and I was lucky that my instructor was many things. He was a paratrooper, by the way, and I was, you know, a 14 or 15 year old. So I learned lots of things. But one of the things he taught me, his name was Anibal Lopez, and he was a paratrooper and pathfinder and like a hard man and a great karate instructor. But I was 15 or 16, and he literally told me, right, you're running the class. Things go wrong, do whatever, get a grip on yourself, and then help other people. And he was very much, he was a hard man, but he very much taught the, you know, it's not to ignore your feelings or not to not say you're not emotional. Of course you are. But it's the ability to get a hold of yourself when really you want to unravel and feel bad or cry, instead to that, take that breath for yourself to stand back up. And in my martial arts uniform, I have embroidered on one side, you know, a relatively famous phrase in Japanese, 7 times down, 8 times up. Hmm. So real success is not making mistakes or errors or failures. It is merely getting back up one more time. And that's why the role of the leader, I believe, if you want to inspire and take care of people, you notice, everyone knows there's a mistake. You will correct that. But now I need you to get back up. I can care about you. I can do all these things, but I'm not going to coddle you in failure. I'm going to help dust you off, stand you back up, and nudge you back into the fray where you can regain yourself and have success. Right. And that's, you know, that's part of my earlier idea on balancing, because having no emotions is a problem. Having too much emotions is a problem. So what is it that you can have in any given space that will leverage maximum opportunity for success. And the role of the leader as a human to human relationship leader is about that. Taking people in their worst moment and saying, look, like, I got it, but we can do this.
Talk about maybe an instance where the team was not focused on what they were supposed to be doing and you had to refocus them. Talk about maybe a real life situation that happens a lot of times with leaders that you got to get people refocused. How do you do that?
Well, for sure. And I'm lucky in one way that I have a generally live, outgoing personality, as you can probably sense even in this. So as a student reminded me at college a little while ago, he put his hand up and said, you're a bit much sometimes. And I said, you are correct by personality. But I think, you know, one of the examples I'll give is I've been so lucky at a point in my career, at multiple points, I was lawfully engaged to command some of the finest human beings on the planet Earth. What a gift that is for me. I don't know if it was a gift for them. It must have been their burden to bear, but it was a gift for me. But on another occasion, purposely, the Army, to teach me a lesson, and I need lots of lessons, gave me what they probably considered the worst company of infantry soldiers in the Canadian Army. And they were all people waiting charges, civilian court-martial release, civilian charges. They were almost all designated as unsuitable to go on military operations. And as a gift, as punishments, that's what I was given. And then there was a time I was very lucky. I've always been lucky to be surrounded by phenomenal non-commissioned officers, NCOs, who are the backbone of a military, who help and share their experience. So I had great NCOs who came with me by chance, but we had a broken group, a group of soldiers who were not proud of themselves, thought they were garbage, didn't like what they were doing, like just didn't. So the part of the talk I had with them was with my sergeant major, we got them together and I said, put your hand up if you want to be just treated like garbage and act like the worst soldiers in the Canadian Army. So no one put their hand up. And I said, okay, and put your hand up if you don't want to be here. If you don't, literally don't want to be an infantry soldier in this company, in this battalion, in this army. And three people put their hand up. I said, good. Thanks for being honest. I will do my best to do administrative paperwork, which I hate, to get you moved to where you want to be. But you don't want to be here, good for you. I said, but the rest of you, I don't understand why you are tolerating being treated like garbage and acting like you should be garbage. And of course, they look at me like I have 10 heads. And a number of years ago when I was at Military College in Canada, or Charm School, as I call it, in military psychology, I was asked to write a paper on elite forces, or I wasn't asked, I chose to, which is a hot topic. And as far as I could tell at the research of the time, there's only three things required to create elite organizations. One, you tell them they're elite. Two, you give them small identifiers on uniform or whatever that identify them as different, some badge. And then three, you change the standards and elevate their performance to cause them in their basic culture and day-to-day activities to actually be elite. And of course, the third one is the hardest, but that was something that we were able to take on. And although someone else would have to declare how good or bad we were compared to others, but after a few weeks and then a few months, we were no longer, these soldiers were no longer garbage because they reinvented themselves inside their own imagination first. They had to imagine differently. And my only tiny role was to give them a creative idea and a spark. And then they did all the rest, especially the NCOs and the young officers who really pull on that burden, you know, minute to minute, day to day. My role is pretty easy. I had an idea and I thought we should do something. And then they did it, to their credit.
Yeah, that's a great story. So talk about the role of leader as communicator and the importance of that.
Yeah. To me, my ongoing doctoral research has continued my thinking, reading, studying leadership over the last 35 or 40 years. And now more than ever, I believe in the separation between being a boss or a commander, we call them in the military, being a manager, being a leader. And all those things are important. So I look at supervisor, boss, commander is allocated authority from above in a orbat, right? An organization chart. Management is generally the allocation of resources and time and space. And management is the only part of the real world. Because 400 kilometers is 400 kilometers and an amount of fuel or amount of rounds or amount of people is real. And the last part is leadership, which I already mentioned, I believe is a subjective, human-to-human, trust relationship, which is the most powerful piece, but it will tend to fight with the other parts. So part of that, commanders need to communicate, and managers need to communicate as part of their roles. But to me, the communication from the leader is a different type. And it might be more implied, and it might be more nonverbal cues, because it's creating the relationship of no matter what happens, no matter what goes wrong, no matter what you do or I do or someone else does, I will take care of you to the best of my ability. And I just need you to be part of this team. So when we all communicate in different ways, and I'm lucky that in some circumstances with some groups, I can be seen as a natural charismatic leader, which is a bit of a gift. Not everyone sees me. Some people see me as an arrogant ass, which I also am at the same time, right? And I think the real challenge of leadership is because it's subjective and emotional and a relationship, everyone in the group needs something different at all times. And I might not be able to give that to everyone at the same time. So I might purposely have to ignore someone who's performing well and go to someone who's hurt or performing less or needs more emotional engagement, if you know what I mean. And it's lucky in a military because we tend to have, although command is singular. So when I was a commander, I had singular accountability. But I shared management, leadership, and command with my sergeant major, my second in command, my operations officer, my adjutant, all these other people, I could divest certain things. The only thing I couldn't divest was accountability. And I think that's another key communication method or key communication point of a true leader. I remain accountable for everything. If it goes well, it's probably you. If it goes wrong, it is definitely me. And I think in many businesses and organizations, that's what people are missing. Because what they tend to see is a boss likes to be a boss. When someone goes wrong, they look and they say, well, whose fault is this? And I'm a believer, if you want to try and be a leader to your people, your answer is, this is on me. What can I do better? And how are we going to correct this going forward? Even if that boss, even if you get some sort of censure or worse from above, you take that and then you decide what happens to subordinates in your own right. You don't step out of the way to let the lightning bolt hit them, right? Because that's what a lot of people have trained at, is where bosses they don't like because they believe they cannot trust them when things go wrong. So
yeah, that's some great thoughts. Every leader that I talk to is a continual learner, and they do it in different ways. But any books that you recommend to other leaders, students that you think are worthy of putting on your list?
No, for sure. Part of it, I'll tell you up front, I love books. It's a gift that my grandmother gave me. She gave me many things to kind of save me because I wasn't a very good teenager, et cetera. But my grandmother gave me a love of books. So the one thing I'd say is read widely and read often. So I can see my bookshelf here. So I have innovation and books on research and other things I'm thinking of, but I also have some science books and physics, and I have some Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. and classics, you know, Plato's The Republic, because reading gives you a bunch of other people's ideas. If I was the two books I hand out to people the most, one, The Jungle Book by Rudyard Kipling, The Jungle Books, because it is the story of Mowgli trying to discover how life works and where he belongs. And the other one that I hand out as often is Alice in Wonderland, which is a story of a young woman trying to figure out how the world works and how they fit in. And it might surprise you, but my doctoral professors, they are seriously annoyed by my view of archetypal stories. Even my biggest one is the Goldilocks effect. Too much, too little, just right. Because I believe in some of these older stories, they're told to bring on messages from 10,000 years ago, like constant storylines. So this, discover who you are, discover where you should be headed, and more importantly, discover when you're in the wrong place. So if you're Mowgli, you're not a wolf. You can't live with them. Be careful of Ka, the charmer. Be careful of Shere Khan, the angry old tiger, and understand how you fit in. And Goldilocks is even better, Alice in Wonderland's even better, because I use it in my doctoral work on leadership and innovation, because the Red Queen is running around in a hurry because you have to have great effort to keep things the same. And that's why in Wonderland, the clock goes backwards, because that's the only way to keep things the same, which bureaucratic institutions always have to do. We have to keep things the same. Nothing can change. Right. And it distorts time and place. So I love all kinds of books, and I try to read as broadly as I can, in case I'm missing out on something that's obvious to someone else.
Well, those three I've not had anybody mention their leadership book, which is out of the box thinking. Yeah, for sure.
Well, that's where, So the funny part with me is that's where I live most of my time. And in a military, I discovered in only 25 years, because I'm a slow learner, they really didn't like me and I didn't like them at all, because they were trying to tell me what to do. And I was trying to tell them what I thought I was going to do or what I thought they should do. But that's also a powerful tension in an organization. Disagreement is not disloyalty, but it's very powerful. That's how strong ropes aren't created by spinning the same way. Ropes are literally created by spinning in different directions. So the strongest ropes, and even a suspension bridge, is held together by opposites of opinions and processes and tensions, right? And as long as they're equal, it's very powerful.
Great. So favorite quotes?
I would say, part of it is too much or too little of anything can cause destruction. The next one might be, well, so what? So my advice to myself, everything in balance. The piece of advice to ignore is everything in balance, because sometimes it has to be out of balance. You can't predict the future. You can't change the past, but you can influence right now. And, you know, maybe the last part of that is the only person on the planet Earth that you own and can actually influence and take accountability for is yourself. One of the things I've done since retirement, I was a youth outreach worker, a street outreach worker for about 9 years for a social welfare agency. And one of the things I learned there is I can only save me. No matter how much I want to do great things, all I can do is manage and take care of myself. And if I'm successful in that, then I can offer something potentially useful to others. But if I'm chasing helping them so much that I'm unraveled, I will soon be the one that needs help. Mm-hmm. Right. And I ruthlessly take other people's ideas and quotes all the time because I'm not that smart, but it seems that lots of other people are.
Yeah. So outside of work, what do you like to do to recharge?
Well, I'm very lucky. I don't even like work. I try. And that, again, what I learned in the military about myself is they were trying to make sure that I understand I was in the military and I had to do these things. But for most of the time, I was just doing my thing and I wasn't ignoring what they were telling me. I just thought that they actually wanted me to do it in my way. That's why I had such a great time. And I'm also lucky, which is handy. But I teach martial arts. I work with Youth at Risk. I'm about to take out my 35th wilderness trip with Youth at Risk. I've always been lucky, and I'm not sure why, but fun and interesting things show up. And I'm terrible at saying no to something that's interesting, that's never been done before. No one else wants to help. It's even better if it's impossible. And, you know, so those things float my boat. What doesn't float my boat, if you saw the rest of my office, was like paper and process. And I can do those. They just don't excite me. I'm more in the, one of the readings I was doing is if you're on the highway and there's a lane next to you, that's the adjacent lane. And then next to that is non-adjacent. So I prefer non-adjacent. But there's also the adjacent possible because the road's there. My preference would be the non-adjacent impossible. Like, we're going to turn off up here and someone says, but there's no road there. And I said, well, there could be if we got our act together. Like, this new thing could occur. Yeah. So a lot of the things I enjoy, including, you know, with my family, and I'm lucky to have daughters and grandkids, and that's all good. And my grandkids always remind me, because they're fresh energy, fresh ideas that are largely unsuppressed by the world, who's going to try and suppress them in the next few years. Sure. And that always reminds me, look at what they can do. They can create almost anything from anything at any time. Huh. Well, why can't we all do that? Like, because, you know, my research on innovation, why can't we just be innovative? And part of it is because we've separated work and life and even play. Like, play is different, but play is probably where we enjoy ourselves the most. We're most creative. We re-energize ourselves. We connect differently, and we can imagine all these amazing things, which is a little bit different than see you tomorrow for the same thing. Don't forget to fill out your 27-3 in triplicate.
So, parting advice you'd give to a new leader?
Well, sure. I think the one thing that I wish I'd done differently is to actively seek and engage with people around you as mentors, to search, could you find someone to help you even for a few moments just by a discussion? And I wish I'd listened to more people who were better than me or further along the trail. And in my role in martial arts now, I'm lucky to be a relatively senior instructor, but in Japanese, the word for that is sensei, which translates roughly to teacher, but that's not what it means. Sensei means born before. So I look at it, I'm merely someone on the same path in my way than someone else who, by coincidence of when they were born, is behind me. So part of my role is to say, well, come on over here, watch out for that, give me your hand, step over that, could I share something with you, right? So as I suggest for young leaders to seek mentors, I would suggest to senior leaders, somewhat like you're doing, you're actively pouring energy into developing other people, which is the gift that a leader can give back over time in their own imperfect way. But they can, as someone's looking for a connection, you can give it. And for that young person, they should be looking not to find everything they could possibly want in one person, because it doesn't work that way. It's to find something and then maybe connect over there. And again, I'll use martial arts as an example. I can only gift people who train with me what I can give them. And my goal is to give them as much as I can so that they'll be better than me. And my network with Traditional Excellence, my little corporation, really, the way I describe it is I try to take people and help them. And if I'm really lucky, I put them on my shoulders. And as they see the bottom rung of the ladder that they want, I lift them up as high as I can until they grab it. And then they'll climb away from me and they don't need me anymore, but hopefully they call every once in a while. And I'm very fortunate in my network from the military and after, many of the folks I've worked with in the groups and teams, the individuals, they're gone and doing these things. So I've phenomenal people. They're flying helicopters and special operations. They're doing these missions. They're CEOs of companies. But my role was very tiny. But my tiny role with the role of other mentors has caused them to climb much farther than I could ever anticipate, because I can't do all those things. Right. So our gift, you know, my gift to them is quite small, but connected to what they have and another gift from someone else could be the thing.
Well, I've enjoyed our time. How would somebody learn more about kind of your work and your company and what you're all about?
No, for sure. So we have our website, traditionalexcellence.com. So my company is Traditional Excellence Human Performance. I am on LinkedIn as Steve Nash. I'm on Instagram and Facebook as Traditional Excellence. And my small group, you know, it's a company of one to few with a very strong network of people that I leverage to try and help out our network and others, right? So I try and leverage one person to help someone else. And I think the best example of that is a few years ago, one of the young men in our group, who is now a helicopter pilot in special operations, he was on the start of his path. And at basic officer training, he was going to be first on the course. Of course, he was a phenomenal young man. But there was someone else in our network that was coincidentally there that wasn't quite doing as well, and they needed a slight nudge. So I was very unkind to that person because I said, could you do me a favor? Could you take some of your energy and just go help that person? And they did. In what they would describe as, I didn't do anything to help, but obviously they did, because that other person made it through. I probably caused the one young person to not be top on the course. He was second. But it's probably because I asked him on behalf of our little group of people to help someone else. But I don't think either one of those will forget that for the next 30 years, especially the person that got help. Because they're also very successful. They just had a bump and they just needed the tiniest of nudge. So maybe that's what it'll close as kind of what we do or what I try and do in our little network.
Well, see, this has been a lot of fun. I've enjoyed your thoughts and your wisdom and definitely wish you continued success.
This has been a pleasure, Mark. If nothing else, you can now certify yourself as level C conduct after capture for spending 35 minutes with me.
All right. Well, thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.